So I'm going to talk about cohomology theory. I've been doing I've been studying cohomology theory for the past half year now, I guess. And I just want to make you understand what cohomology theory is, sort of, because I don't think a lot of you actually know the actual definition of cohomology, for example, but it's surprisingly easy to define once you know what exterior derivatives are, for example. So, first of all, because you're all physicists, I would like to tell you something about what the implications are, the physical implications. First of all, we have the Aronov-Bohm effect. I think you probably all know this. Let me just draw it. What happens is sometimes you have sort of a shift. If you integrate a vector field around a closed loop, you can have a shift. Which is captured by cohomology theory in the sense that you know that normally if the curl of a vector field is zero, it must be conservative. But this doesn't necessarily hold for manifolds which are not equal to Rn or something like that. For example, if you have a circle, you can sort of get a vector field which has zero curl, but still, if you integrate around it, it will give you a non-zero number. It's not a conservative vector field. For example, this vector field, which just goes around like this. In fact, this does have zero curl, but it's not a conservative vector field. And the Röhm cohomology is exactly what you need to kind of describe this discrepancy. Second of all, we have something called the Euler characteristic. I think a lot of you also know what the Euler characteristic is. And the nice thing about the Euler characteristic is that you have something called the Hopf index theorem. This is probably not really related to physics, this point, but the Hopf index theorem basically says that if you have an Euler characteristic that is non-zero, then any vector fields you have on your compact orientable manifold must have zero somewhere. So that means that, for example, if you want to find out if a manifold is a Lie group, because a Lie group must have a nowhere vanishing vector field, you can kind of figure it out by the Euler characteristic. Say you have a sphere, the normal sphere, which has Euler characteristic 2, then you know it cannot be a Lie group because it has to have a vector field which, all vector fields vanish somewhere on the sphere. So you know that it can be a Lie group. Third of all, Feynman graphs apparently also have this sort of connection to cohomology theory. You probably already know this formula on the right, but it can actually be easily derived from the cohomology definitions, the definition of cohomology theory. For example, if you have simplicial cohomology basically what it does is if you have a topological space, it kind of counts the number of vertices, counts the number of edges, counts the number of faces you have. So what happens is that, for example, if you have any Feynman graph, let me just draw something. So say you have something like this, then what happens is that we can sort of make a correspondence to these vertices, edges, and faces by filling in the loop with sort of a solid. In the sense that you get something like this. Now, the nice thing is that this space is contractible. I mean, you can sort of compactify the face. Let me just draw it better. You can sort of compactify it in this sense, so without changing the Euler characteristic. Then you can contract everything to a single point. So now that you have a single point, you know you can easily calculate the Euler characteristic, which is 1. And we get this correspondence between vertices, edges, and loops, and this Euler characteristic of a point, which kind of proves this formula in that sense. B is the number of loops, which correspond to phases. You fill them in, then you can. push them together to like a point. So the main thing about cohomology theory is that it's very easy to calculate cohomologies in the sense that we have a lot of calculational tools which often can be like which can be used in other parts of mathematics as well. For example, homotopy theory is very difficult to calculate in general, but what happens is that there's like some sort of connection between homotopy theory and cohomology theory, and then we can suddenly use all these techniques we have for cohomology theory on homotopy theory, which makes the calculations easier and which gives us like non-trivial results. And secondly, cohomology is also important in string theory, because we've seen in previous lectures that we have something like BRST quantization. So we quantize gauge theories, and what happens is we can sort of define a cohomology. And we are, yeah, I don't know a lot about this, but we can sort of, we're sort of interested in only those correlation functions which correspond to non-trivial, like cohomology, sort of. Yeah, perhaps it's better if you watch the string theory lecture about that. In any case, cohomology is very versatile. Like, there, if you have different structures, you can often define different kinds of cohomologies. For example, you can define a Durham cohomology if you have something like a smooth manifold, and you can define a differential, like exterior derivative. Then you can define Durham cohomology. But sometimes you can also just define different cohomologies. For example, you have something called the Czech cohomology, which you define through an open cover, like an open cover of your manifold. You can define the Czech cohomology through an open cover. And what happens is that if you have reasonable assumptions, if you have reasonable spaces, these cohomologies are often isomorphic to each other, which is kind of strange, but also very, very useful. Because in that way, you can sort of connect these two distinct like theories with each other, like algebra or geometry, and get like nice results in either of them. Like you can use different techniques in geometry for algebra and vice versa. And last but not least, a cohomology is like a topological invariant. So topological invariants are just very important if you want to know which spaces can and cannot be continuously deformed to each other. Like everyone knows you cannot deform a circle continuously into a line. And this can be captured, for example, by cohomology theory. And I'll show you that the cohomology of a circle is in fact different from a line, which proves that the line is not homeomorphic to the circle. So first of all, I want to define like the Durham cohomology. It's very important that you know what the kernel and image of a map are. So the kernel is basically everything that gets sent to zero. So if you have like a map between groups, the kernel of the map is everything from the first group that gets sent to zero. And the image is, well, I mean, you probably know what the image is. So on a smooth manifold, we have this exterior derivative, which goes from forms, like I forms to I plus one forms. You might know this from classical mechanics because it was defined over there. And the main thing is that d squared is equal to zero. Because if d squared is equal to zero, we know that the image of d lies in the kernel of the next d. Because if d squared is equal to zero, that means that whenever you apply d, you get into the image, then you apply another d, and you get into the kernel, sort of. So we can actually define a quotient in a well-defined way. So that's the main thing. It's kind of a weird definition, I guess, but intuitively, what Durham cohomology counts is sort of the number of holes in your space. So a circle has sort of a one-dimensional hole, a sphere has a two-dimensional hole, and the Durham cohomology sort of counts these. So that's, yes?
Is this H a number?
No, it's a space. And in fact, it's a vector space over R normally.
It's not a group because the image is not necessarily a normal subgroup. You're not necessarily quoting about a normal subgroup, so H isn't That's why H doesn't have a group structure.
Well, but these are real vector spaces. So in fact, the H is also a real vector space.
There are abelian groups.
Well, in general, there are abelian groups. But in this specific case, your omega is, in fact, a real vector space. Or, yeah. So that's what makes it well-defined in this way. OK, so we can think of the Rumb cohomology intuitively as the number of holes in your space. So what are some properties of the Rumb cohomology? Well, first of all, it's only defined for smooth manifolds, because we use the smoothness of the manifold to define a Rumb cohomology. So you cannot define it on a general topological space. Secondly, like I said, it's a natural vector space over the real numbers. And thirdly, through the definition of the Rumb cohomology, it is in fact already invariant under diffeomorphisms. I'm not sure if you remember this, but it's not very important. But the reason is that if you have a pullback of a map and exterior derivative, these two commute with each other. So that means that, like, the kernel gets sent to kernel, image gets sent to image, so you get a well-defined map between cohomologies as well. And we also know that if you have a diffeomorphism and you take like the tangent map, it must be an isomorphism. So that kind of shows why it's invariant under diffeomorphisms. But what's actually weird is that it's even stronger, because it turns out to be invariant under homotopy equivalence. And homotopy equivalence is kind of like a contraction. For example, if you have the real line, you can contract all of it. You can like sort of push it all together continuously to a point, which shows that the Rumb cohomology of a point is equal to the Rumb cohomology of a line. This is a very important notion, because with this, we can actually calculate, for example, the Rumb cohomology of a circle. So first of all, the main technique used is an exact sequence. And this is a sequence of maps between spaces such that the image of one map is the kernel of the next map. It seems like a weird definition, but the fact that this happens, like you have image which goes to kernel, gives you like an extra structure to calculate the Rumb cohomology. I'll show you later on with some examples. It will give you some easy way to calculate some exact sequences. Fun fact, I mean, whenever the image of a map is contained in the kernel, we can define a cohomology like we saw before, namely d squared is equal to 0. So a map applied to another map is equal to 0. This defines a cohomology. But in particular, if you have an exact sequence, it means that the kernel is equal to the image, so that any cohomology is trivial. And yeah, exact sequences turn out to be the main technique for calculating cohomology. Mainly because of some theorems, which I will not tell you right now. So first of all, if you have this simple exact sequence, what happens is the maps from 0 to A are inclusion of 0, and the maps from A to 0 is sort of the constant map to 0. So we know that the image of 0, which is 0 in A, is equal to the kernel of 0, the next map, which is equal to A itself. So that means we have this equality that A is equal to 0. So A is just trivial. Whenever some space is in between two zeros in the exact sequence, it's trivial. It's 0. We could have actually gotten this out of like this example. But let me just show this separately. So we have three exact sequences. And what we see is that since the image, for example, for the first exact sequence, since the image of 0, which is 0, is equal to the kernel of F, it means that the kernel of F is trivial, which means that F must be injective. So whenever a map comes after a 0 map, it must be injective. Now, for the second one, we see that the image of G is equal to the kernel of the 0 map. The kernel of the 0 map is all of D. So that means that the image of G must be all of D, so it's surjective. So if a map comes before a 0 map, it must be surjective. So in this case, we see that this map between A and B comes both before and after zero map. So it must be bijection. So it must be an isomorphism. And we'll use this quite often, the fact that if you have two spaces between zeros, they must be isomorphic to each other. And as you can see, I mean, if you put B equal to zero, you'll immediately see that A must be isomorphic to zero because of the same notions. Now, since we're working with the RUMP cohomology, something gets easier because we're working with finite dimensional vector spaces. So we have something called the rank nullity theorem, which relates the dimension of an image of a map to the dimension of its kernel of the map through like the dimension of the vector space. Let me just write it down. Perhaps that's easier. So if you have like a map F between two vector spaces, we know that the dimension of the image of F plus the dimension of the kernel of F must be equal to the dimension of T. So since the only important thing about a finite dimensional vector space is its dimension, we can like sort of get a constraint on what kind of vector space we can have in this exact sequence. And the constraint is given by well, this formula beneath here. So we know that the dimension of the last vector space must be equal to like k1 minus k2 plus k3 minus k4, et cetera, et cetera. So we can actually we can actually already find one of these spaces if we know all the others. So that's really, that's kind of impressive. Now, I just want to calculate the RUMP cohomology of a circle. It's like the simplest example. And let me just show you what you can do. We have something called the Meyer-Villator sequence. What we do is we have a manifold, and we can split it up into two open pieces. If we do that in the following way, say our manifold is S1, and we take these two opens. We see that they're isomorphic to R. Both of them are isomorphic to R. The intersection is isomorphic to the disjoint union of two R's. So what we'll get is like this. We'll get this separation in two opens, which are isomorphic to R, and with the Poincaré lemma, which states that any contractible manifold, on any contractible manifold, all closed forms must be equal to exact forms. We can find that the cohomology of these two opens are given by, like, are only non-trivial in the zero degree, which gives us like an easy way to calculate the Meyer-Villator sequence of a circle. Sorry, the Meyer-Villator sequence is up here, and what we'll do is we'll put M equal to S1, we'll put U and V equal to R, and we'll put the intersection equal to R disjoint union R. What happens is that in zero dimension, this will give us the zero dimension of the circle. This will give us R plus R because they're zero dimensional. This will give us R plus R as well because we have disjoint union of two R's, which will give us R plus R. Is that clear? Okay, we have the disjoint union of two R's. So the zero dimensional cohomology, the zero degree cohomology, kind of counts the number of disjoint, kind of counts the number of connected components. So what happens is that we have two connected components, which means that for every connected component, we get a vector space for R. We get a vector space R. So we have two connected components, so we must get something like R squared. So we'll get R squared, and we'll get H1 of the circle. And after that, everything is trivial because of that last line over here, because of the Poincaré lemma. So we split it into two opens. We use Poincaré lemma, and we get the following cohomology of a circle. Now, I just told you that if you take the zero degree cohomology, what happens is that it kind of counts the number of connected components. Since we know that the circle is connected, we know that H0 of S1 must be equal to R. So we already know that H0 of S1 must be equal to R. And now you can use the fact that these are vector spaces. So we know that the dimension of H1 of S1 must be equal to 1 minus 2 plus 2, which is equal to 1. So we know that H1 of S1 must also be equal to R. So we find that the cohomology of S1 in zeroth and first degree are the same, are just R. And if you just calculate the higher degree cohomologies, we'll see that they'll get squeezed between two zeros. So they must be trivial, so they must be zero. So the only cohomology a circle has is in zeroth and first degree. So that was actually surprisingly easy, because we've never used what these maps actually are. I mean, I've given you this exact sequence, and I've never needed to use the exact definition of the maps between these spaces. I only needed like the structure of the exact sequences, sort of. In general, it gets more complicated, and you need to use like different techniques. But the fact that we're working with vector spaces just makes things way and way easier. But normally you would have to do it by hand, but I just don't have time to show how to do that. So we'll get these cohomology of the circles. And actually we can see like the first cohomology sort of corresponds to in how many ways you can have these vector fields that go around the circle, which are not conservative but still have curl zero. So we can see that we have like one possible vector field that way, sort of going around like this. So that's kind of special about RAM cohomology. It sort of shows you, it gives you some topological, it gives you some idea of your manifold just through some really easy manipulations. Yeah, I actually think I might not have time for this anymore. Do I have time? Well, for the next two slides. Okay, and that's not new. Okay, then that's all I want to tell you. Are there any questions?
I wanted to ask, how do you define H0?
H0 is like that. That's kind of a special one, because what we say is that. So you know that this just consists of all smooth functions. And all we do is we just set this one equal to zero. So in fact, H0 is defined by all functions, smooth functions, which have exterior derivative zero. So it's all constant functions. That might clear up why it kind of counts the number of connected components, because you put a real number on each connected component. Right?
Yeah.
Yes?
Can you go into the cohomology spaces for a circle?
Yeah.
So if you did this over on a vector space over a general field that wasn't R, but maybe like Z or something?
Yes.
Would that change? Are you assuming something about the characteristic of the field or something?
Yeah, in fact, you need to know that it's a vector field. Because if it's a vector field, you can have an exact sequence. So let me just explain this. Like, I've really used this equation, but if you did not have vector fields, like you might have Z, you would get something called torsion. For example, you can have an exact sequence that looks like this. Can you see this? So there's in fact like sort of an extra term which could not have appeared if this was R, because then the dimension of this must be zero, because this is 1 minus 1 is 0. So the dimension must be zero. But in fact, because we're working over R, these kind of terms, this torsion, will just throw away this information. But if you're working with different kinds of cohomology, if you're working with different fields, you'll get this information, you'll get like extra information about your topology through this set 2, for example.
Can you tell us something about a physical interpretation of general cohomology?
Yes, so physical interpretation is
Or application.
Oh, application. Well, the main thing about the RUM cohomology is that it is basically defined in such a way that it counts the number of affected fields, such that the curl is zero, but it's not necessarily conservative. That's all the RUM cohomology does. So like the Aronoff-Bohm effect is like a really beautiful example of the cohomology in practice, sort of.
So could you say that it kind of extracts the forms, the differential forms, which are like closed but not exact?
Yes, exactly. You take all the closed forms, you divide by
the exact
like forms. The exact forms. That's exactly what it does.
Are there like some fermionic analog of these things? Or I mean, I know that you know, for example, these elements of this cohomology crop up as solutions of the Laplacian. There are zero modes of the Laplacian on manifolds. So that's basically the homological point of view with holes in them. So I was just wondering if there's a like a version of it where instead of Laplacian, we have Dirac operators or something analogous.
If you're saying that the there's a solution of the Laplacian that gets mapped to zero, that requires like a lot of mathematical background, which I do not like have at the moment. So I'm not really sure. There might be, but I just wouldn't know about that. Yes?
In the proof that you've done of what are the cohomologies of the circle, you have assumed the existence of that exact sequence? Is there always an exact sequence between any one here, the Meyer-Vittori sequence? You have to prove that such a sequence exists.
Yes, so what happens is that whenever you have so these omegas, the omegas are called like the complex. It forms like a complex. In every degree, you have like an omega. So whenever you have a short exact sequence of these omegas, for example, for the Meyer-Vittori sequence, we get something like this. We get this exact sequence. Whenever you get like a short exact sequence, a finite exact sequence, you can like create the cohomology of the sequence. And what happens is that these maps, because the maps just are well defined in cohomology, these maps are well defined in cohomology, so you can just like take the cohomology at this point, it gets mapped. Like you'll get cohomology here, you can go to the cohomology of this one, you'll go to the cohomology of this one, through like well-defined notion. And the nice thing about cohomology is also that there exists a map that brings you from like all the way over here back to over here, but in a degree higher, which is exactly, if you go from Hn of u intersect V, you'll go to Hn plus 1 of the manifold. So whenever you have short exact sequence of a complex, you can extend it to a long exact sequence of your cohomology. And that's why exact sequences are actually so important, because you have this theorem that says, oh, whenever you have a short exact sequence of your complexes, which happens quite often, or you can kind of arrange in such a way that it happens, you can extend it to a long exact sequence of like the Meyer-Vittori sequence, and you can just use all these tools I just told you about to calculate the cohomology in an easy way without actually knowing what these maps are.
And we are out of time, so let's thank Troy again. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Dibra. Well, I'm going to speak today about causal sets, which is
can you turn on your mic?
Yes. Isn't it on? Okay. Is it okay here? Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I'm going to speak about causal sets, which is an approach to quantum gravity. It's the approach who was created between several people. One of them is Raphael Sorkin, who is a faculty member here. And he's my essay supervisor, so I'm going to work with some theory with that. OK, so what are we going to introduce in this talk? We are going to introduce basically what is this formalism is about. We are going to introduce some arguments for justifying the assumptions we are going to make. We are going to explain the theory itself. We are going to make it quantum because we want a theory for quantum gravity. And we will finish with some next steps that we have to do with this theory to advance. So the causal set theory is based in a discrete space-time, as it was the spin formalism that Chingwen explained last week, the space-time atoms. So you may be asking, why do we need this discrete underlying structure of the universe? Why don't we stay with our cute and soft manifolds? So we have two important reasons. One is that we have some problems with continuum. There are some singularities that appear in quantum theory or general relativity that may be solved if we have this discrete structure. For example, if we have this minimal scale, this would be a natural cutoff for our quantum theories, for our momentum intervals. And another stronger example is the entropy of a black hole that is pointing out in this direction, as we can see with some toy model. For example, we can support that we have a black hole and a perfectly spherical black hole, yeah. And we suppose that it is divided in some regions of space with some fundamental length L. We can suppose that in each region we have some degree of freedom, some spin or whatever, which is analogous to have one bit. So we can have 0, 1. So if we do the computation of the number of microstates, it would be 2 to the n. So the entropy would be something proportional to this n, which would be the area divided this fundamental area squared. And we have recovered Hawking's formula for the black hole. So this is pointing out to say that if we then compare it to formulas, this fundamental length is precisely some constant that appears in this Hawking formula, which is precisely what it's called the Planck scale. So this is why we think that our space-time could be discrete. So okay, let's start with what our theory is about. The theory is based in some mathematical structure, which is called a causal set. And what is a causal set? So it is a set, some kind of elements, which will be our points of space-time. So we will represent some points here. And we define, furthermore, some order relationship between them. This order relation will mean that if two points are connected, they are on the light cone of the other, they will be in the future. So this point can be on the past of this, the same for that, and whatever. So with this definition, we are recovering a concept as time-like connection or space-like if they are not connected. For having this definition to be consistent, we have to impose transitivity. For example, if this point set is on the future of y and y is on the future on x, we'll say that set is on the future of x. We also are going to impose no cyclicity because this is kind of unphysical. One point cannot influence on itself. And local finiteness, which means that between two points, the number of connected points is only a finite number of points, because if not, we will recover a continuum formalism, which is exactly what we don't want to recover. So now, from this set of points and connections, how do we recover a space-time? So these points can be embedded in a manifold sometimes, which means that we can approximate this set of points as a manifold. So we can have our manifold, and we can think of the causal set as points living on this manifold. And for this structure, we can recover all the geometric information or all the physics of our manifold. for example, these lines can define our light cones, can define our time like geodesics, can define our which points are space-like. So this is going to give our causal structure. And for recover the whole metric, we need to have some notion of volume. And the notion of volume that we will have is the simplest one. It's just counting elements. The number of points that we have in our causal set will give us the volume. For example, we can think of every single geometrical definition, every physical thing. For example, a time-like geodesic is defined as it was defined in general relativity, is the line that maximizes the proper time. So if we want to from X to Z, using a time-like geodesic, we have to follow the line with the more number of steps, with the biggest proper time, which in this case will be going through Y instead of going through. No, we have some extra point here, it will be from Y and Y prime. Okay, but furthermore, we want to impose some extra conditions. We want a manifold that is faithful embedding, which means that the density of points in this manifold is constant to recover the notion of number of points volume, and that it's Lorentz invariant. And it can be proved that if we start with a manifold and we choose the points of, we choose some random points of the manifold to be these elements of the causal set, this manifold is faithfully embedding the causal set that we are picking. For being this random, it has to be a Poisson distribution because it keeps our constant density and the Lorentz invariance. We can show it with this example. This is a Minkowski spacetime, 1+1. This is one space direction, one time direction. So we start with our empty manifold, and we, sorry?
What was your idea of Lorentz invariance for a causal set? Because did you define a distance before? Or?
Sorry?
So you said your causal set was Lorentz invariant.
Yeah, we're going to go a bit later, yeah. So okay. This is our 1+1 Minkowski spacetime, where we have randomly pick some points to be, which will be our causal set. We can see that bigger, looking from it from a big scale, the volume density is constant, and now we have to show that it's Lorentz invariant. Okay, so we can compare a random lattice with a regular lattice. And what we are doing here is do a Lorentz boost between both sides. And we can see that the random lattice transforms as a random lattice, while the regular lattice transforms as another regular lattice, but which is not as homogeneous as the first one was. So that's why we don't want regular lattices. This can be understood with the case of a crystalline solid or a gas or a liquid where the particles are randomly distributed. You can see that the solid is not isotropic, there are preferred directions, as happens here. Okay, but we have to remember that we don't think that there is some real underlying manifold, that the real thing are just the points. So this splinking is just a tool or some description, but it's not real. Furthermore, not every set of points with this relationship has to look like a manifold, so we can have something more strange. So we can ask if our universe is really like a manifold. And for we will think that our universe would be like a four-dimensional manifold embeddable causal set. But maybe it's not so easy. For understanding this, we have to introduce the concept of coarse graining. So coarse graining is the same that we saw in statistical physics. It's like looking to our system from a bigger scale. A way for doing this with a causal set is we have some structure. You have, instead of taking all the points, taking just some random points to represent our original causal set. And the funny thing is that the topology or the geometry of our causal set is different depending on the scale in which you are looking to it. One example for this can be a cylinder. Imagine that we have our points of the causal set living on the surface of a cylinder. And when we coarse grain this causal set, at the end we can have is that it looks just like a single line. It's like if we look at this cylinder from a scale much bigger than its radius. So this gives us a lot of possibilities, like the causal climb mechanism that we saw in gravitational physics, or it gives us possibilities of as having 26 hidden dimensions in string theory or whatever. So, well, now we have some fancy interpretation for geometry, for general relativity. I want it to be a theory for quantum gravity. So the way of making it quantum is not very clear. There are defined some kind of analogous to path intervals with some discrete sums over all possible causal sets. It gives an amplitude to each one. But for doing it properly, we have to find some action that we hope that in the classical limit will give us the four-dimensional manifold. So this is one of the problems that we have to, one of the next problems that we have to solve in this approach. There are some other problems, because, for example, non-locality. These links union into points is something that is very non-local, so it can be non-compatible with our quantum theories, so it can be a conflict, or maybe not, but it's something that we have to think about it. We can also think of the problem of time. If we have our static manifold, maybe there is not such a thing as time, it's just an illusion for the particles moving on these points, on these lines. And an important thing for this theory also is to make predictions. So, yeah? It's the same problem of time.
It's the same problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
what
maybe
is the problem of time?
Huh?
What is the problem of time?
Oh, it's in general, you usually have think of the universe as a manifold, and it's nothing that changes. While in quantum theory, the past is something like well defined, and the future is probabilistic. It's nothing well defined. So this is conflict between these two theories. So it's you have to see how to solve this problem also.
Is this essential in causal sets, like in a way that it isn't in other? Is this like an essential problem in causal sets in a way that it isn't in other quantum gravity theories? Because
No, I think it's the same problem that I, yeah. So when defining this path, intervals have to be how to deal with it, which is not very clear. Yeah.
How does the classical side of this theory look like? I mean, we saw that we can kind of understand it in a heuristic way. I mean, how you can model a submanifold with a causal set. But is there any equation of motion that this causal set satisfies, or is there any way to, given a matter of
given
quantum,
like
you
the,
like, what would be the causal set?
Equation, you mean, or
yeah, I mean, the dynamics of this causal set, I mean, is that somehow prescribed? Because it looks like you can always build this thing, right? But if you say you have a certain matter distribution and you want to see how does the causal set look like that is connected to this. I mean, is there any equation of motion or anything similar?
I guess there is. I haven't seen any, but I guess there is already something that we have to build, yeah.
I think probably the more speculative questions we can like reserve for the Q&A session.
I just wanted to ask, you say that you can start with like a random set of points.
Yeah.
And you basically want to connect them following if they're time-like connected.
Yeah.
But that supposes the notion of a metric. And you said that not all causal sets are actually manifolds.
Yeah.
So where does this metric come from? How do you define this relation?
You just define the relation. One point has effect on the other. It's the basic thing. There is no metric. I mean, your equivalent of the metric is this connection between points.
Right, but like, if you have a set of points here and you want to connect them, you've got to have some prescription to say they are light or like, no, sorry, or time I connected, how do you tell that apart? Or are you supposing
it's,
that
it's just at random if you want. You could have written, you know, one point here, one point here, another point here, disconnected. It's just a graph.
It's just a graph.
Elements, yeah. So you have some set of, yeah, X, Y, Z, and then you add some relations between them. But these points are nothing geometrical. We understand them as something geometrical because our causal.
The notion of causality actually comes, it's a posteriori, right? You just start with a relation that is like a transitive and has like a partial ordering and something like that. And then after that, you try to interpret this as being like a time range.
Well, yeah, you understood that as at the time of your manifold, yeah, but it's causal function, yeah. Okay, so what I was saying is that this theory makes some predictions. For example, it gives a good estimate of the order of magnitude of the cosmological constant, but we have still to make more, to work more and see if we can make a consistent model of it for quantum gravity. So yeah, the conclusion of this talk is that a discrete version for quantum gravity is possible, it's consistent, but there's still much a lot of details to clear, or at least I have to learn about how to do that. So thank you very much.
So suppose you've given a particular causal set. Is it possible that it could be embedded in many different Lorentzian manifolds?
Yeah. It is possible, but they would be equivalent. There would be a diffeomorphism
between
different. Both of them, or and it is proved in some paper. Yeah.
When you said that the distribution for this screen was Poisson, that was like a numerical approach, right? It's not fundamental, as you said.
It is, it is. Yeah, because we don't think that there is really an underlying manifold. It's just an approximation we do. Or
you do like numerical calculations or something?
The drawing I have said, this graph is doing numerically, yeah.
Because I was kind of, like, especially when you're talking about the density of points, the row thing, I don't know, I feel like it should happen that if you have like a crazy space-time, you know, with singularities here and there, you should have to basically resolve the points with more like resolution, you know, close to these things than, you know, basically have a, like if you had a grid, like if you're trying to do an American simulation and have something which varies too fast, you should also have more points in there to resolve this thing. So I didn't really understand how is the relation between the causal, this manifold structure and the density of points.
We want to do the identification of number of points in some region with the volume of this region.
Right.
So if you threw more points at some special region, it will give you the volume of it at the end. So I don't know, why should you throw more points at some?
I feel like if you don't have enough points, you don't have as much information about the causal structure, right? If you have like some chaotic causal structure, then you would need to have more points. But then you also automatically increase the volume. So it feels like you're trying to, constrain two physically unrelated quantities. Or maybe I'm getting wrong.
But your information doesn't depend on the number of points.
Oh, it doesn't?
Well, yeah, you have more, but you don't have more information in a singularity. Well, if you have a singularity, maybe the volume also goes up in that point. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Is it fair to say that the density of these are events in space-time, each point, right?
Is it fair?
These points in the causal, these are space-time events, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so is it fair to say that the density is setting some characteristic length, the length that you were talking about when calculating black hole entropy? Because
yeah,
like higher
sure.
density would be like the points are space closer.
No.
No.
This link is not any any length. It's just that there is a connection, causal connection between them. It's not...
Yeah, you're talking here about like a bunch of space-time atoms, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Where you're connecting them like causal, relationships. Could you see this as like a coarse graining of other kinds of quantum gravity? Or does anybody like so the fact that you're talking about these points, like maybe these points have some intrinsic stuff going on, right? Like maybe these are, you know, tiny tetrahedra, blah blah blah. But so could you see this as like, you know, a very large scale approach to certain other kinds of quantum gravity, or is this not?
Wanted to say yes.
That's interesting, but what could be more fundamental than a point? I mean, or a single element?
I mean, there's you know, a couple of natural, quote unquote, reasons to take certain other things, which is like when you quantize GR. And a point is not necessarily one. But yeah, you could see that as like, you know, very, very zoomed out of the.
Yeah, but what do you expect? Like, tetrahedra? Like, in this.
Suppose.
Yeah, but the tetrahedra has a volume, has... And, yeah.
We talked about predicting a cosmological constant. Can you actually like spit out a value for it and compare two experiments? Or you may have many different values corresponding to many different causal sets.
I'm not sure how does it do the computation. The thing is, in this approach, we have some uncertainty principle recently, like in quantum mechanics we have with positional momentum. Here we have with volume and the cosmological constant. So it predicts some fluctuation of this cosmological constant of the order of what you have seen. So they say that the cosmological constant of this model would be zero, but it has some fluctuation of the order that we have observed. So it is
The order of what?
Of the observed cosmological constant.
Okay.
Which is something very little.
But the input is the volume of the universe, right?
Yeah.
Sorry?
The input is the volume of the universe, the observable universe.
Okay.
Then what comes out is the fluctuation of the order of the observed cosmos.
Okay. And does it agree when you actually plug it in?
Yeah.
Like, does it agree reasonably well with
the least order of magnitude?
Okay, if there are no further questions, thank you, Alvaro. The function which is defined as a sequence of cosines and sines. And you can see, so if this was like a cosine omega t, then the 1 over n goes as omega. So if we're starting with n equal to 1, then we can see that the highest frequency that this this function would have is 1, when omega is equal to 1. And so all the at all higher values of n, then we would have smaller and smaller frequency components coming from this sequence. So here, if we looked, for example, at just summing between n equals 1 and 10, then we get this Fourier spectrum here, and we see that all of the frequency components that show up when we do the Fourier transform are at values of omega less than 1. So we see here this is the highest frequency component that we see, and nothing else is popping up higher and higher values here. Now, this is not the whole story for this function. It turns out that there's actually some oscillations that this function has, which are cropping up, that have higher frequencies, but they don't show up in Fourier transform. And so we'll just have a quick look at how that's happening. So here we have, we see how this function is behaving as we're increasing the size of large n. So we're adding more and more of these oscillating cosines and sines, cosine and sine terms, and what we see are two interesting things. So first of all, we see this region near the origin is getting isolated in the sense that the amplitudes of the region around it are increasing. So this ratio between the region here, the amplitudes in the region here and the region outside is diverging. Now the second thing that we notice is if you keep your eyes on the center of the screen here, you'll see that as we increase the number of elements in our sequence, the wavelength appears to be getting shorter and shorter in this region. So as we add more and more as we increase the sum in this sequence, we end up creating a region whereby this wavelength is shrinking smaller and smaller and smaller. So we can have a quick look at what this would look like for a very large, well,
somewhat large n, as large as I could manage on my little computer, n equals 200. And here I've just rescaled the functions that we can see all the amplitudes, and we don't have this crazy divergence. And so if we have a look in this region near the origin, we can just eyeball what the wavelength is. And the wavelength, of course, here, since we're looking at this function in terms of time, then this would be this parameter tau. So it's about roughly 2.5, maybe 3, something like that. And so we can get the frequency that corresponds to just by this relation here. And we see that this ends up being a number which is above the original band limit that we had, which was 1. So we see that we've got something curious happening here. We had a function which was defined as a sum of oscillating components whose frequency did not, was there a question?
It's 1 for n equal to 10, right? But this example is n equal to 100.
So it's always going to be 1, because if you look at how we've defined this function here, even if I increase big N, what's going to happen is these components say this would just be, if I put n equals to 100, for instance, this would be cosine t over 100. And the corresponding frequency coming from that function would be omega equals 1 over 100, which is smaller than 1. So I mean, you would get more and more and more things coming in over here, but it would still be below this value. And this is the upper band that we're talking about, that upper bound that we have imposed. Okay. And it just comes simply from the fact that we're starting at n equals 1. Yeah. Okay, so we have this function behaving such that it has frequencies which are above the band limit and not showing up in the Fourier spectrum. So this is kind of weird and kind of interesting, but this is really just a toy function. Ideally, if we want to be able to play with these things and do something useful from them, we want to be able to control what the superoscillating region is doing. So we want to be able to control the length of the superoscillating stretch, and we also want to be able to control what frequency it's oscillating at. Yeah, sorry, Alex.
When you have that function, which looks like an exponential but isn't really one, right? If you do, but that series is not of the Fourier series of the function, right? It's one way of expressing the function, but it's not a Fourier mode decomposition. If you do decompose it in modes, wouldn't you see these higher frequencies?
It turns out you don't. So it turns out that what's happening is there's these large oscillation amplitude oscillations outside of this superoscillating region are interfering in just such a way that they're canceling this superoscillating behavior. So you can do a more detailed analysis, and I haven't had time to properly look at that or anything, but you can see that that's actually what's happening, that the entirety of the function is interfering in a way that this is producing this behavior in this particular region. So that, yeah.
Is this plot of the superoscillating region, or it has the whole function?
So this is, so the superoscillating region, so because n is still relatively small, ideally for this particular toy function, we'd want to take the limit n going to infinity, in which case we'd see a clear region where we have something that's oscillating at a fixed frequency, so it has some perfect sinusoidal behavior in a region, and then beyond that we have this exponential divergence in the amplitudes outside it. So here it's not particularly clear. You maybe have a little bit of a super oscillating behavior in this small region, a few wavelengths around the origin, but you would need to look at much, much, much larger values of n in order to get for this particular function. So this is just a toy example to kind of illustrate the key idea. So, were there any more questions before I move on? Yeah.
When you said the high frequency modes that show up on your Fourier transform, what region are we considering this function to be in time?
How do you mean?
When you find the Fourier coefficients, you have to integrate over some region of time.
So I suppose for this function, because it's a toy and we're just playing around with it, you would take infinity. You would take the limit to be infinity. Okay, so we'll have a look at, unless there's any more.
In some sense, you're saying that the Fourier theorem is breaking down. And is this because these are not square integrable functions?
No, they're square integrable because you want them to be, because you want to be able to construct wave functions for them. You want to be able to normalize those wave functions, and you should be able to take the norm of them. And we will take the norm here, and we'll show that it's.
The function that you showed in the previous slide
So this particular function, yes. In this case, because we are, okay, so this example was perhaps a bad one. In this case, I think you're right, is we take the large n limit, we're going to have diverging amplitudes. In that case, this one won't be square integrable. But that's why this is just this is an example function that we don't really want to do anything with. Ideally, we want to impose some different kinds of constraints in order to construct these things. So we want to construct one of these functions that we can actually do something useful with. And the first thing we want to do is specify how large this super oscillating stretch is going to be. So we can do that by specifying a series of constraints up to so we can specify some points here. For example, pluses and minus ones that would confine some nice sinusoidal or cosine behavior. And the next thing we can do as well is to specify the spacing of these points, which will fix the frequency of the oscillations about that in that stretch. So we want to ideally make that that spacing smaller than the band limit minimum wavelength implied by the upper band limit on our frequency, or in the case of wave functions in position and momentum space, and we talk interchangeably then about momentum instead of frequency. So we have some constraint which we define, and we then say that our wave function at these positions which we've defined should be equal to those constraining amplitudes, and we can move into momentum representation by taking the transform of our wave function. And we can just rewrite our constraint equation in this way using units where h bar is equal to 1. Now, because we've said that these amplitudes are something fixed, ideally, since we saw previously that we have some kind of behavior whereby outside the super oscillating region, we have the amplitudes somewhat becoming quite a bit larger than the oscillating region. And we want to make sure that our super oscillating region has somewhat tangible amplitude in comparison. We want to make sure that ratio isn't too large between this region and the region outside. So if we've set if we pick some points that would confine our super oscillating stretch to look something like this, then what we want to be able to do is if there's a possible function that satisfies these constraints, which has a large amplitude here, or another possible function which has a smaller amplitude, well, we want to pick the one that has the smaller amplitude. So for that reason, we're going to minimize the norm. So we have a series of constraints, and we have a norm that we're trying to minimize. So we've essentially got a variational problem on our hands. So we can write down a Lagrangian for this problem. And so we have these mu's here represent the Lagrange multipliers for our constraints that we're imposing. And so if we use Euler-Lagrange equations on this Lagrangian, we see that since this form doesn't have any explicit dependence on the psi dots, then the first term cancels out and our Euler-Lagrange just reduces to the form we see here. And so if we calculate this the variation with respect to psi star, then we have this following equation here, which says that this integral is equal to 0. And we could in principle try and look for some odd function which would satisfy this relationship, but this is perhaps that's a little bit outside the scope of what we're trying to do. So it's much simpler to say, well, we can satisfy this equation simply by setting the thing in the brackets to be equal to 0. And so we get this relation here. Now, what good does that do us? On the left-hand side, we've got something we don't know, and then we have the Lagrange multipliers, which we don't know. Well, what we can do is if we just go back, we can take a look at how we defined our constraints in terms of the psi of p's, and we can try and plug this expression that we just derived in and see if we can get anything useful out of that. So we put that into here, and we see that we have an integral dp of this exponential form. And this has dependence on the position, these amplitudes, say at some points k and some points r, these positions that we've defined. And so we can say that looks something like a matrix element. So we can define a matrix S whose elements are defined by that integral. And on top of that, we can evaluate that integral, and it turns out to be something like this. So S turns out to be a matrix that we can count, we can compute. So on top of that, we can notice that it's kind of convenient that if we swap K and R, we see that we get minus on top and a minus on top. And the whole thing is invariant under switching the two. So our matrix is symmetric, which is nice. It means we have to be computationally less work for us when we have to evaluate this thing. So now we have that A is expressed in terms of these matrix elements and the Lagrange multipliers, which we're trying to identify. So it would be nice if we could invert the matrix S, and we'd be able then to just identify our Lagrange multipliers from there. So the question then, is it invertible? Well, let's consider a related question if it's positive definite or not. So if we apply, if we take some vector y and we apply y dag on S and y, and I think the star should be on the other side. It's the same thing. So when we evaluate this sum, when we evaluate this, we see that we can rewrite, since S was given by this exponential of two terms here, we can break that down into two exponentials, which sort of look like a complex conjugate of each other. And we can see that we can just rewrite this in terms of an absolute magnitude, which is always going to be positive. And so when we evaluate that integral, we always get something which is positive. So that means our matrix S is positive definite. And so it's invertible. So this means that we can solve for our Lagrange multipliers, which is what we were trying to do. And then we can plug back in to the equation that we got from our Lagrange equations, this form here, and see that we can solve for our wave function. And if we take the inverse transform back into position space, then we end up with a wave function in position representation of this form. And we can just evaluate the dp integral, and we see that we get our wave function given in terms of a sequence of sinc functions, which are shifted with respect to the origin. And all of them are bounded by this Pmax. So they're slowly oscillating with respect to the fast super oscillating stretch sinc functions, which are displaced with respect to the origin. And we've all just put them together as a linear combination. So then if we want to do quantum mechanics with this thing as well, we can just normalize our construction using just by dividing by the norm. And we see that, of course, the original amplitudes which we've imposed will be decreased, but hopefully they're decreased minimally, since we've by solving this in this way, we've minimized the norm. So next we can look at, how am I doing for time? So I'll just quickly run through this because I want to have some time to talk about applications as well. So it turns out if we want to examine how the super oscillation, the amplitudes here of our super oscillating stretch are scaling with when we increase the length of our super oscillating stretch, or when we try and increase the frequency of the super oscillations, then we find that they can be related to the eigenvalues of our S matrix. And then it can be shown that these scale in the following way. So if we fix the length of our super oscillating stretch, if we fix n and we try and decrease the spacing between the points so that we're increasing the frequency, we see that we get a polynomial drop in the amplitude of the oscillations in that region. Whereas if we say then fix the spacing between the points and try and increase the size of the stretch, then we end up with an exponential drop instead. So all of this is good and pretty, but on paper. But what good is it really? So if we gave this to an experimentalist and they managed to produce one of these things for us and they gave it back to us, what could we use it for? So let's consider a single slit experiment. And we know that if we send a plane wave at a single slit experiment, by the uncertainty principle, we're going to get a spread in the momentum coming from that. So that would imply that if I send in this plane wave, there's a possibility that when that particle comes through the slit, that its momentum has possibly increased. So if I measured the particle, say, up at A, then I know that it's acquired some transverse momentum when it went through the slit, and it has a larger total momentum than it did before it went through the slit. And so it's acquired some energy, so through its interaction with the slit, and so that means that the
this whatever the screen is that has the slit in must have lost some energy to the particle. And so it's essentially, it's acted to cool that screen. So you could imagine now that we could do the same thing with a super oscillating wave function. We could take a single slit, and we could align some super oscillation such that the super oscillating stretch is aligned with the slit. And as this wave function then approaches the slit, there's going to be some probability that it'll be transmitted through. And after it's transmitted, well, we know that this guy had some frequency, had some maximum frequency showing up in its Fourier spectrum, say P max. After it goes through, the only part of the wave function that will survive is this part that had the higher frequency. So now we're going to have the surviving part of the wave function that comes through the slit will have a larger frequency, momentum. And so we can interpret this as the particle having been accelerated in a sense, in that it's started from having a smaller momentum here, and now it has a large transverse momentum when it comes through the slit. So that acceleration has to have come at the expense of some energy supplied by the slit. And so we can think of the super oscillation as it travels through this slit as having acquired energy in the form of heat from the slit. And so this object, the screen, has essentially been cooled. Now, of course, cooling implies ordering, and ordering doesn't spontaneously happen. So this implies that if we want to make this happen, then either one of two things have to occur. Either the non-superoscillating part of this function carries a converse heating effect, such that it counters the cooling that we've seen here, or else producing these kind of waves is entropically expensive, in the sense that in order to counter this spontaneous cooling that we have here. And it's unclear which is the case. This is, I think, still an open question in research. So on a completely different note, right. Yeah.
So what if you did that experiment with the slit being at zero temperature?
That's a good question. I don't know. See, I think a lot of this stuff is still completely speculative. The problem is that actually constructing these things in a lab is somewhat difficult. So I don't know if people are at the stage where they actually could even try this. I think it's just, at the moment, kind of a speculation. But I don't know. That's a good question.
But your problem there about where the energy comes from, it seems as though it's like a single-shot experiment where you just manage to extract energy out of it and violate the second law of thermodynamics, which can't happen. Mm-hmm. But given that the amplitude of your super oscillating part is very small,
exactly, yeah,
it seems like most of the time you'd be reflecting it.
Yeah. Or would be absorbed or something by the slit here. Yeah. So I think that's probably something along those lines is what's happening. I'm not too sure. So we can look at another reason we might want to use a super oscillation. So let's suppose that we have some system with some energy levels. And it starts in some level n, and we're interested in some transition between n and m, which has some energy given by delta emn. And so if we were to apply some source which has a frequency, some normal oscillating source at some frequency which is less than this transition energy, we would expect that there would be no resonance, and therefore there would be no promotion to the nth level. So, however, if we were to apply a super oscillating wave function whose super oscillating stretch does have the resonant frequency of this transition, then if that stretch has some temporal duration given by tau of s, then we could expect one of two things to happen. Either when we apply the super oscillating wave function to the system, during that super oscillating stretch, the system is promoted to level m, and the system has no internal dynamics which are faster than the time scale Ts, tau s, then when the non-super oscillating part of the wave then takes over, the system is simply de-excited and nothing has happened, and the wave that we get out is completely is unchanged from what we originally had. On the other hand, if there's some interesting high energy dynamics going on in this system, then the time scale of this kind of this dynamics could result in some kind of dissipation of this energy from these excitations that we get here, and we could see the loss of the super oscillation from our we would see, in essence, the loss of this behavior from our wave function. We could potentially investigate different timescales within systems. So just to conclude, what we've seen today is that super oscillatory functions are functions whose behavior is hidden from their Fourier spectrum. We can construct them from a sequence of sync functions, for example, if we want to. The amplitudes of our super oscillating stretch scale polynomially in terms of decreasing the spacing between the points that we want to specify, and exponentially if we try and make the stretch longer. And a few reasons why people are interested in super oscillations is that we can potentially use them as cooling rays or to probe high frequency dynamics. And so this was just a brief taste of some of the things that people have been thinking about to do with super oscillations. And I'm by no means an expert, so thank you for your attention.
Talked about how you can apply these super oscillations, but how can you actually create them? Is there some kind of potential or something that you can write down in the toy?
So that's actually something that I'm starting to work on right now, is whether or not we can generate, say, wave functions who are the eigenstates of some potential. So you might be able to generate some funky looking potential like this, I don't know, something weird. And then it turns out that this thing has an eigenstate which is some super oscillating wave function, but this is, I'm not really sure at the moment where this is going and how it's going to turn out.
So I had a question. I don't really see what's going on in this example, because if I were to calculate the output wave, I imagine that I could do it just, you know, for each Fourier component and then add them together, and so I shouldn't get a Fourier component on the other side that didn't exist. Oh no, but it's truncating. Okay, yeah, now I understand. I'm answering the question. Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay, so let's thank Lady.